Hello, everyone, and welcome to NWR Connectivity episode 389. I'm your host, John Reardon, joined, as I so often am, by Neil Ronahan.
Hello. Today is a holiday. Another Rare game is coming to the Nintendo 64 on Nintendo Switch in December, in a nebulous time frame that Nintendo of America won't confirm, probably because it's right before Thanksgiving and Japan was just like, hey, this thing's coming out soon. And they're like,
trying to get out of the office and crap. Okay. Also joining us today is Jordan Rudick.
Yo, how's it going, guys?
How is it in your country post Thanksgiving? We're still pre Thanksgiving as we record.
The time difference is crazy. Yeah.
I think it's a lag of what, 3 or 4 weeks?
Yeah.
I think everyone here is still trying to work off all the food they've been eating. All the very, very expensive food. I don't know if it's the same thing for you guys in the States, but groceries are just nuts here. Like the cost of buying food at a store. Going to a restaurant is one thing, that's expensive and continues to be so, but I just remember buying all the stuff for Thanksgiving. Like, we've never spent this much money on a Thanksgiving ever. So I'm like, oh my gosh, it's been crazy.
It is. I don't know if either of you have an Aldi near you at all.
Yeah.
But that is my grocery store of choice. I don't know if it's gotten to Canada yet.
Unless
I recommend it.
Yeah, maybe Eastern Canada, but not here.
It is. I mean, I think it's like there's. We could start talking about niche grocery store ownership, but it does have like ties to Trader Joe's. Like the parent companies, I think at one point were the same and then split or something like that. But it is in that vein of, you know, like smaller footprint discount, like usually lower prices. But having gone there for a while, with one being down the road from me, I have like the rock solid of like, this is how much a thing costs in 2018 versus now. And it has been wild seeing those prices go from like this bag of chips was like $1.25. Now it's like $3.
Exactly.
When like that, it used to be such a, now it's like the price that the like Tostitos brand stuff is at a, you know, a normal grocery store, as opposed to the like wonderful savings that I would get by buying the off-brand thing.
I feel like now if you're not buying something that's on sale or you're getting some kind of offer back, like you paying regular price, you're just dying. You get to the end, the bill's like twice what you expected, what you're kind of like estimating in your head for it to be. And it's like, what did I buy? Like, did I put something in my cart that I forgot about? You know, did I buy like an extra chicken or like a turkey or some expensive meat? Like, I'm not getting like,
there's just a thing of crab legs
here, you know? Yeah.
A bunch of crab legs just hanging out here.
That's right. Yeah. A whole king crab is just kind of crawling around your car. Like, oh, I forgot to put that one in. Yeah, it's kind of nuts. I did find an Aldi in Toronto, so I don't know that it's in Canada proper, all over the place, but they're probably.
I mean, Toronto's basically the States.
It's basically Buffalo, right? So, yeah. It's Buffalo small or little, something like that. Yeah.
It's Buffalo with some different U's and stuff.
That's it, yeah, just slightly.
I'm glad that everybody could join us for our grocery store podcast where we talk about the latest in grocery store news and discounts. But we're going to switch topics a little bit here because Jordan, beyond just being our friend that we like to hang out with, is also here because Jordan released a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of
a good book.
Kind of crazy. It's like having another child and I have to constantly monitor its progress and make sure everyone knows about the child and take pictures to talk about the child nonstop. not available at any grocery stores yet, but I did write a book. It's called A Game in the Life. It kind of started as features I did for NWR. So this has been like a kind of a 3-year journey. I looked back to when I first posted the video and write up for the Timeless Games series. The first entry was Mega Man 2, and this was 2020, like April or March 2020, something like that. So, yeah, 3+ years later, this has metastasized into a book, and it's available. You can buy it now. It's currently only an ebook, but that is not going to be the case for very long. Where the physical version is well into the works, and it's just a matter of things arriving to me on time and flipping switches and seeing how long the processes take to make it available for people to buy. But Yeah, A Game in the Life it's here. I'm happy about that. I'm now like switching over from the writing part of the job to the marketing part of the job. And so that's kind of where I'm at right now.
Yeah, this has been, anybody who's like, especially, you know, if you've been subscribed to the NWR TV YouTube channel for a long time, like you will recognize some of the theming and topics of this book from those timeless videos that you did. It feels like a lot. You said 3 years. It feels like it was forever ago.
I know. Like, it does feel like it started a longer time ago. But I mean, maybe we talked about it before this even came to fruition. But yeah, the first video was in 2020, and I think I ended up doing like 8 or 9 or 10 of them all told. I think the last one might have been Fire Emblem Awakening. And so and after that, it was kind of like, okay, I've got like the skeleton of half of my book. I might as well just kind of proceed through. And so in the remaining years after those kind of videos and write-ups had gone up, I set out kind of planning what the rest of the book was going to look like. You know, thinking about how could I extend all of these pieces into book chapters. That's obviously part of the process. And a lot of it, you know, a lot of the kind of last year has just been procrastinating. I guess that's a big part of writing too. That's a big part of any kind of content creation, is the way that you can just not do it and be like, oh, I'll do it later. You know, at some point it'll get done. You just want to tell people, oh yeah, it's happening. It's coming out. It's in progress, and it can be in progress forever. But at some point I just had to sit down and do it. And so, for my line of work, the college that I teach at, every third semester is a vacation slash it's called non-instructional duty, kind of like what a pro D day would be for teachers. I have like 2 months of that basically, where it's like, do your prep time for the next year, do your go to conferences if that's your thing, work on research if that's your thing, or, you know, write a book. And so I dedicated my non-instructional time here in the fall of 2023 to getting the book finished, doing all the editing, figuring out this whole publishing angle. And so that was kind of it. It was just like, okay, it's September. I'm not teaching right now. I got to sit down and get this done. And so that was kind of the final kind of straw, or the final, I was a nail in a coffin. Like, it's a negative thing. That was the thing that made me get off my ass and just do this, you know, like that kind of the jump started the ending of it, I guess. Yeah.
It's funny for me to hear you say like that you were procrastinating getting it done, because I'll kind of give a little peek behind the curtain. But like, we had been, me and Jordan and Neil had been discussing like, what would it take to publish books? Like, if any of us wanted to write a book, like what would that be like? What would the process be like? Could we do that? Is that something the site would ever be interested in doing? And we're talking about that, and Jordan's like, well, I have a book that's like done.
Yeah,
and we're like, oh,
it's true. It's right. Yeah,
it's similar to like you and I think after recording an episode, we're like, like we should do some videos on specific developers. And I'm like, I've got 2,000 words on Masato Kato just hanging out right here.
Yeah, like unpublished, just here. I have this. Why?
I Chrono Cross came out, man, and I felt compelled. Like,
it's like we're digging around in boxes. Like, hey, I've got a book here. I've got a book.
Yeah.
You know, like, here's a manuscript I wrote like 10 years ago. It's just kind of crazy how things kind of popped up. And I'd forgotten about the discussion. You know, you're right, John. We'd been having these discussions all year, and part of it was in the late spring, early summer. I met with one of my colleagues. And we were, I think the three of us were talking about, okay, yeah, how do we publish this thing, right? We have things we can do. We're like, maybe we want to go this independent route. Let's look into what our options are. And so I'd spoken to a colleague at work who had just used the website that I used for my book. It's called Draft 2 Digital. And it's been an incredibly smooth process so far. And I think that's helped with kind of getting the whole thing, you know, published out there. Is just that it ended up not being as difficult as maybe the procrastination would have you believe.
Yeah. And I'll throw out there that, like this, obviously, like to be clear, Jordan self-published this book. This book is not published by NWR. But if NWR doing books and publishing things like that is something that you think you would be interested in seeing, like, we are definitely taking the reception to A Game in the Life as sort of an indicator of people's potential interest. Yeah. So it's like, it's what, $5, right?
For yeah, a digital it's copy? $4.99 yeah. US, and then if you're in Canada, $6.99 or less, depending on the exchange rate, probably sure. less. So yeah,
it's cheaper than your groceries. I can tell you that, yes. even if you're shopping yes. at Aldi.
There is almost no item at the grocery store more expensive than my book these days. Like that's how bad things have gotten. Part of that was I wanted this book to be accessible to a lot of folks, right? Like I wanted, you know, it's my first book. I want to get it out there. I want people to read it. It's meant to be something that can resonate with people and make them think about their own experiences, you know? And so getting it into more hands is much more important to me than making money on this book. Like it's not really about turning a profit or something like that. It's about getting my work out there. And I think it has a kind of an important message or goal in mind of the kind of reminiscing that I think is valuable, that I think it's cathartic. You know, I think yeah. that when we think about our past, you know, and we can associate it with the games we played, the books we read, the movies we watched, the TV shows, all those things. I think that kind of forming those connections is a good thing for us to do, a good thing for humans to do, you know? So that if anyone could read the book and one chapter just sticks out to them, like, I read the Final Fantasy VI chapter and gosh, I remember I was playing Final Fantasy VI at the time and my brother and I were getting really close and we started playing games and that was kind of the start. I want people to kind of think of it that way or maybe have those kind of moments of reminiscing. That'd be wonderful. And if you do, you know, please reach out to me, you know, reach out on Twitter, send me a DM, Twitter X, whatever, send me a DM. Let me know. I'd love to hear from people who have had those kind of positive experiences after going through the book.
Yeah. Cause it's a cool combo of game history, but then also memoir, I guess. Mm-hmm. Calling it a memoir feels yeah. weird, but
yeah, but it is. I had to do that in classifying it. Like I'm like,
right.
It's not a memoir per se, but it has memoir qualities, you know?
It kind of is a memoir.
It is. It's just funny to say I'm writing a memoir at 38, you know, like,
yeah.
like halfway through my life.
All downhill from
another,
here.
Another game in the life.
Yeah, that's
coming
right.
in 40 years.
Game in the life, too. I'm 78 yeah. years old, you know.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
I mean, it is something that I'll type out my reply to you on Twitter. But I'm working my way through it slowly but surely. And it is funny because like some of these, I'm like, oh yeah, I do remember when Jordan had that article and video yeah. on yeah. the site. And then just seeing it more built out, but it is that personal touch. Mm-hmm. It is also like imminently relatable. Like you're only a couple years older than me. So a lot of the experiences are in the same ballpark. And even some of them, like I always feel like just with my age and John, you probably feel the same way that like there is a little bit of that, like NES Super Nintendo era that I just I probably was just too young to really experience that at the time. Like my earliest
the
memories,
entirety of the NES era for me. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's like if I look at some of like my knowledge of the video game industry, like 95, 96, like N64 yeah. launch is more of when I'm like, that's when I can say like, oh yes, I remember these things contemporaneously. I remember mm-hmm. when I saw Mario 64 for the first time. I can't really tell you like, when did I first see Super Mario World?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like NES was big for me. Like it was really big. I think my dad, I think has a lot of responsibility for that. Like he just kind of really pushed it. We rented games every week. We rented one or two games from either Blockbuster or the grocery stores coming back again. They had like, you know, they had the video game rental sections and they had the weirdest box covers, like these plastic covers. And they'd have like, would look like a wrestler on the front. I remember these orange and yellow, ugly ass font. But I mean, we would go get groceries. We would get a game, you know, we would go to my parents want to get a movie for the weekend. We're going to choose a game or two. Like, you know, then we're kind of separating our two domains, right? My parents are in the TV room watching the TV. We're in like the game room or the bedroom where the NES is set up. Like I never owned that many NES games, but we rented hundreds. It felt like, you know,
right.
And only some did I ever rent multiple times. I really didn't rent games multiple times until we had a Super Nintendo. And until like,
yeah,
it was like, okay,
then it was almost necessary
for sure. Like this, cause the Super Nintendo, like the line when we had it at launch and it stayed at my grandma's place and there weren't many games at the launch of the Super Nintendo. Right. So we would have the NES as well, and I'd rent like one Super Nintendo game and one or two NES games. And they probably had deals at like Rogers Video or Blockbuster Video where you could rent three games for like $10 or something like that. So you always got like a combination of the two platforms. But yeah, I mean, I played a ton of NES, like just a ridiculous amount. And it's just funny not really owning or keeping or possessing any of those games for a long time. There's a fleetingness to it, right? Like there, and maybe that was why I was able to capture so many memories. Was like, I rented this game. We had a great, I played it a ton for like 2 days and then I never played it again. You know, and so that weekend is kind of burned into your memory a little bit too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like Neil said, that I mean, yeah, for me that would be the N64. But I
100% that is the one that I have the memories of renting a bunch of random games. And
yeah,
I mean, like N64, a lot of my systems, like NES and Super Nintendo and Genesis, were all like platforms that existed around me as I was younger, but I was like building collections for those in the late 90s.
Yeah.
Like for me, it would be instead of renting NES games, it would be going to Funko Land with a $20 bill and coming back with like six games.
Yeah.
That sounds like heaven, honestly. That sounds awesome.
Oh man. Dude, they used to have like the newspapers that would have the game prices. Like, such warm, fuzzy memories.
Really, and then, good.
And then GameStop bought them all and ruined everything.
Well, and now $20, you can put an NES game on layaway, and after five easy payments of $20, it will be.
Say those $20, like half of those would be like $1.99, like Magic Johnson's Fast Break or something that. A lot of sports games that are still not really worth much of anything.
Yeah, they're worth more than that. Those are climbing.
I will defy you live on this.
Okay.
For my very specific.
What price did you say it would be? $1.95.
We'll say Magic Johnson's Fast Break loose price on price charting $4.
Yeah, double what you paid, Neil.
Sounds like an investment to me.
Yeah. I will. I mean, it is down from its peak. But it's also like with this, it's like there's only like one. Oh no, there's only like two sales this month, but there were a lot in October. It looks like
Big month for that game.
Yeah, it's a big September 2022 was its peak at $7.42.
Ooh,
it's funny that actually October 2021 is its lowest at $1.
Boy,
price charting is fun.
Amazing, that's a lot of fluctuating. That's crazy.
Yeah,
I think it's this guy in New Jersey just flooding the market with.
Yep.
It's just Neil.
Yeah, come to my garage sales if you want. See, Jordan versus Bird 1-on-1. Where are we at with that?
Why are they all in the black Tengen cartridge shell? Like, who's been hoarding a bunch of those?
Yeah, 200% increase. It is. I mean, it's going on the tangent of just getting old video games back before the prices got ridiculous. Is in early 2000s, I was able to get my own eBay account that I had to like get traveler's checks to pay for stuff with, which pissed off my parents. But because I was an eBay account, it wound up getting hacked at some point, so I don't have it, but I was able to, like, in 2012 or something, go back to see, like, these Super Nintendo games that I bought in 2001, and all of them were, like, a quarter of the price that they were worth at the time.
Ridiculous stuff now, yeah.
I suppose to wrap up talking about Game in the Life, Jordan, people can buy this pretty much anywhere that you would normally buy a digital book, correct?
Yes, for sure. So if you check out Nintendo World Report, there's a news article that has a link to basically all the places you can buy it. If you check out any of my social media, so on X, at RiskMan64, Instagram, same handle. And I've been tweeting about it. I'm going to continue to keep tweeting about it. So if you're listening and you're sick of me by now, sorry, it's going to get worse. But yeah, it is basically everywhere. It recently came to Amazon and Google Play Books. So I know those are a little bit more popular. So if you have a Kindle, you want to do it there. Google Play Books, you can just download an app on your Android phone and access it that way. Barnes & Noble, Kobo. There's also like sites where you might subscribe like monthly, and it's available there. One is called Everand. They actually have a free trial. So I got to pump the tires on that one. So if you do the free trial for 30 days, you can read the book there for free. It still counts as a read or a sale for me. So you're still supporting the book that way.
Ooh,
and you would cool. just hang. Generating money out of nowhere when you do that.
Gotta love it, right?
It's amazing.
Yeah. So lots of options. If you are looking for like the link to find like all the stores, it's books to read, books number two read.com/agameinthelife. So if you're able to remember that, or if you even just search A Game in the Life, maybe A Game in the Life and then the word book or my last name, Rudek, you should be able to get a link to a store that will work for you, hopefully. But yeah,
it's available. I bought it on Google Play. That is nice, as an Android user, my book reading app of choice.
So ebook now, hopefully within the next like 2 to 4 weeks, a range, maybe longer. I don't know. Hopefully sooner.
Like before the end of the year.
That would be fantastic. Probably. Yeah.
Seems like a good goal.
That might slip. The goal of like, hey, I can do the stocking stuffer marketing. Like that would be fantastic. So for the physical copy, that's what I'm aiming for. So stay tuned for updates on that. But
stocking stuffers for my kids.
That's right. Yeah.
Neither of them can read. I'll just barely hear.
This is going to be your first book.
It'll grow on you.
Get to work on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
When you're old enough, you're going to write your own book like this.
Yep.
Or your dad's going to, but someone's going to. Yeah, no, that's good.
With that, I am going to start the ball rolling on something, and then I'm going to go take a nap. But some game called Super Mario RPG came out last week.
Never heard of it.
What is it?
My opinion, before these guys can talk about this game and love on it forever, is that this is a pretty boring, bland RPG that people only like because Mario's on the cover. All right, guys, take it away.
Good synopsis.
Well, I mean, you started it. I will say, it's not just because Mario's on the cover; it's because it's weird as shit.
It is.
I thought you were going to say it's because he's in the game too, and I would have. That's fair.
No, because honestly, I mean, like, while Mario is charming and adequate in this game, it's all the weird periphery stuff that, because it's been so long since I've played through this game as I'm working my way through the remake, like, it's funny seeing a lot of people be upset about the direction of, you know, your Paper Mario and Mario and Luigi games over the years, and going back to this game, and it's like, I don't think any of the things that came after this are quite as weird and preposterous as Super Mario RPG. Just the frantic pace, the weird characters, like the honestly non-Mario like diversions that are throughout the entire game.
They're so great. All the bosses, I love them. I love I don't care. Their old names, new names, doesn't matter. I still like them. I love their personalities. They all have a different personality. And they're all just wacky and dumb. Haven't really seen anything like that. We haven't really seen anything like that since. Like, you get one or two here or there, but you don't get a game filled with this collection of just dumb idiots. I love it.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where like even the dumb bosses are still fun in some way.
Yes. I love the Axiom Rangers are the best. I don't care. I love them. Yep. I love every single one of them. They all have this personality. They look stupid. Like, oh, they're great.
Probably one of my, I guess probably about midway through right now, getting to the Axiom Rangers one is always a highlight every time I play this game.
Yes, for sure.
And also cannot wait to get to it in the remake. It is just like, it's so dumb. And I forget if we talked about it on the podcast at all, but it was like who the hell was making this game?
Yes.
The remake. It's Art Piazza is the primary developer. They did some of the remakes of Dragon Quest. I know they did, I think they did the 3DS port of Dragon Quest 8. Ages ago did like the Dragon Quest 5 DS remake port.
Yeah, and 4 as well. They did the 2D part of Dragon Quest 11.
Yeah.
I'm like, I love that. It's so good.
It's the best part. No, I mean, like, the kind of thing where like it is, I mean, it's a developer that's primarily worked with Square Enix in the past. And I guess technically they did again, but I think Super Mario RPG was a Nintendo driven production from everything that we can define from the credits. But importantly, Taro Kudo is involved with this. He was involved in the original game. It's weird that they did not get the original director has been out there like talking about the game in like a Min-Max interview and stuff. He was not involved at all. I mean, it gives a stamp of approval to it. But Taro Kudo, who is formerly of Vanpool before it got shut down, but one of his first games was he worked as an event designer on Super Mario RPG and then went on to basically just do a murderous row of wackadoo shit. It was game designer on Moon Remix RPG Adventure, worked on more games with like that weird batch of developers, a lot of which came out of Super Mario RPG. Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga, did mini games, was the director for the Tingle games.
Okay.
The voice of Dylan from Dylan's Rolling Western. The one we don't talk about, which is director of Paper Mario Sticker Star. But then also
that's why they brought him back.
But also the writer and director on Color Splash and Origami King, and a producer on Chibi Robo Ziplash, which all of those games are like, I am noted Chibi Robo Ziplash defender. And I think if we ever do some kind of like weird 3DS spinoff game club thing, that will be my pick. Chibi Robo Ziplash, very much a mid platformer. But the surrounding weirdness in that game is on a tier that I don't know if Nintendo has ever been on before, where you just find a bunch of snack foods throughout all the levels. There's just it's potato chips for some reason in that game. And it's like international snack foods. Anyway, Taro Kudo is incredible. And the fact that he got to go back and work on Super Mario RPG again, like when I heard that, I was like, okay, all of the weirdness is still going to be here.
Yeah.
This guy is one of the industry's noted, will be a part of games that will make you like your head curl into a question mark.
Do you think he's involved because he is still associate? Like, I guess if Nintendo views, you know, Paper Mario still as the modern Mario RPG, I guess it makes sense to put him back into a remake of the first one.
Yeah, I mean, he has ties to every type of Mario RPG, as it were, because he worked on Super Mario RPG. He did do, I mean, was like a, you know, developer on Superstar Saga and then involved with the three most recent Paper Mario games. And he was, and I mean, Vanpool. It is weird, like, the timing of this, because Vanpool died this year, and I don't know if how long has this game been in development? It's something that I'd be very curious about.
Right.
You'll probably never know.
It has to, I mean, longer than a year, surely. Like,
yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It's a very direct remake, but, like, it ain't like it's using any of the assets from the Super Nintendo one. I assume it had to be rebuilt from scratch, so.
And Art Piazza, I don't know what they've done. You look at their website, I think Romancing Saga 3 and Dragon Quest XI S, like those are the last two projects listed. So yeah, it could be a number of years for this sure.
I may be remembering wrong. The 2D mode in Dragon Quest XI, wasn't that pulled from the 3DS version? Or was it
different? Believe Art Piazza worked on the 3DS version.
Right. That's what I'm saying, though, is like, how long ago did they actually do the 2D mode?
Because
that 3DS version was contemporary with the PS4 release, which didn't have the 2D mode. That didn't come out until the S version. So it may have been a while since they did even that.
Yeah. So then the most original thing would be Romancing Saga 3. That was 2019. Looks like November 2019, something like that. And they're just listing all the platforms that the game came to, basically. So that could be like the last heavy listing kind of thing, right?
Right, so 3-4 years of development. That sounds about right for what this is.
Yeah.
But I take it you guys like the remake so far.
It's incredible. Like, it's exactly what I wanted to see happen, where they didn't sanitize this game at all. I guess the only thing that they did was change some of the boss and enemy names, and just names across the board. Like Frog Fuchsius is now just Frog Sage. Mac, which is the first star boss at Mushroom Kingdom, which I think the name that they replaced Mac with, Clay Morton, is dumb, but it was very confusing in the original because Mac is a pun on Mac the Knife, the Bobby Darin song. And the person on top of that, like, the knife is not the person. There is a weird little dude on top of the sword. So I guess that makes that distinction a little clearer.
Yeah.
But it's still a pun. I do Throfer. Muku got turned into Throfer, which is just a gopher who throws.
It's good.
Like, that is good. Yeah. I mean, this is also the kind of thing where it's Treehouse taking a pass on localization.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was a game that would have done, I think it was a Ted Woolsey. Was it a Ted Woolsey joint?
Yeah.
It was a guy who did a lot of Square games back in the 90s. So there's some stuff, but like they, for the most part, they left the script intact. It's very good that they have a lot of the same weird jokes. A highlight of this game for me is, honestly, I think the entirety of Booster Tower, just because like it's weird. You've got Proto Wario, or I guess it's not even Proto Wario, because this came out like as Wario was on his way to getting his own game. But like Booster is just a gross, bizarre character that at one point, like, Peach is crying and he's like excited to taste her tears.
Like, when he like opens up his mouth and like his head tilts back, like it's in his mouth, becomes like a circle. It's just I love that animation so much.
And then even in the moment of that where at Booster Tower, where you can find a Chain Chomp, that then Bowser's just like, yo, let me handle this. And the camera just tilts, you can't see what's going on. And then Bowser's just like, yeah, I tamed her. and then now he has a Chain Chomp weapon.
Yeah.
And everything with Bowser in this, like, it really is the start of Bowser's character has become.
Mm-hmm.
Although it isn't quite the romantic that the movie has cemented it as far as his love for Peach. But it's just seeing like how he's just like, oh no, I need to be tough in front of Mario. And like just seeing him kind of lose his army over the early parts of the game, like it does. It's not like this is Shakespeare or anything, but it just does it such a good job at making this villain have at least a minor bit of sympathy of the fact that like his world has been turned upside down, much like everybody else's.
One good example of that is when you reconnect with the minions who fled his army, right? He encounters them at like stores or houses later in the game.
I think Monster Town has a lot of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of them there. And he's
Jagger's
like,
there. Yeah, because Jagger is with Jinx.
That's right. And then the Goomba's somewhere else. I don't know. I don't remember where, but you meet them and then it's like, oh yeah, they're like scared, like, oh, Bowser's gonna be upset with us, like, oh, we deserted him, but he's not. He's like, hey, I understand, like, it was a tough time, like, you know, I get why you left. You've got your family to support, all that stuff. It's very funny to see that coming out of that character. It's very sophisticated, but I love it, actually. I think it adds a nice depth to him. This is the game that it's responsible for making him like this really kind of lovable loser type, you know. And I like that about it. I like this side of Bowser, and I'm glad that it kind of continued to build after this game.
Yeah, and like it does make me long for when Mario and Luigi games did a good job at giving Bowser some depth. I mean, Bowser's Inside Story, I think, is the hallmark, but there's some good stuff in those, especially when they don't have Bowser be the end-all be-all villain, and he is kind of in a supporting role.
Neil, I wanted to ask you your impressions of like the jumping, specifically Mario's jumping, like you must have super jump by now. I find the timing quite hard in this game for the jump attacks. Like the regular attacks I'm fine with, but Mario's jump has been eluding me a little bit more in this game than the Super Nintendo one.
I haven't tried as hard.
Okay.
I think the most I've gotten to is maybe 15-20.
Yeah.
But I mean, I haven't made an attempt because I think, what is it? There's some reward if you get like 99 in a row or something.
Yeah, if you get the first reward at 30, and then there might be one or two after that. And again, like 99 might be the top one. Yeah.
Yeah. I also have you been playing it on TV?
No, I've played it only on my OLED.
Okay. I was curious if maybe there was some kind of lag issue, because I I haven't noticed anything different with that. I do, I do like the somewhat subtle thing that it does, at least on the normal difficulty, of it does give you like the an exclamation point to be like, this is when you press the button.
But not every time, right? Like, I don't know what governs it.
What I think it is if you do it right, then it will stop doing it.
Yes, okay.
Because
okay.
I've had times where it was like, I think I was just like, distracted or something, and I like didn't do it right. And then the next time I would have it back. And it really did seem like it was tied to like, if you're in rhythm, we're going to take it away.
Yeah, like maybe if your combo meter is at zero, right? If you're restarting a new combo meter, maybe that's when it comes back, right? That would stand to reason.
Yeah. I do. It is funny. We were talking about this before, too, about how the playtime for this game is way shorter, just in general, compared to the Super Nintendo version. I think some of it is just the way the game runs, probably runs a little quicker. But it's also the way that they do what they added to the battle system, I think, does make it a lot easier, but also makes it a lot quicker. The main things is that combo meter where you can do powerful triple attacks where like I've timed that for bosses and damn near one-shotted bosses.
I felt like that too.
It is very overpowered in certain uses.
There's also the combo meter that builds up and it improves your stats. I've been trying to kind of figure out exactly how, but I mean your defense goes up, I think your damage, like your special attack. Yeah, right, exactly. And but I find like I have basic attacks that are doing more damage than some of my special moves sometimes, just based on where I am in the combo chart.
Yeah. And then just the fact if you have perfect timing, it does splash damage.
Yeah.
Which if you use that well, you can basically just like knock out groups of enemies effortlessly. Which is fun. I kind of don't mind the little bit of overpoweredness with it. And for people that are I guess it'd be cooler if there was a harder difficulty level or something, but do what I did back when I used to replay this game every year in the 2000s, which is avoid most battles and only fight bosses.
Just don't grind at all, right? You don't need
I forget what the lowest level I got to the end of the game with, but it was frighteningly low. might have been like the mid-teens fighting Smithy. Or something like that. Because I would just basically, like, early on, I would avoid everything except for mandatory battles.
I remember some of the later game fights needing, like, some of the boosting items, like Energizer and stuff like that, where you could, like, pump up everyone's attack or defense or even Rock Candy to, like, deal out a bunch of damage to the enemies. Like, I haven't needed items really at all. Like, and that's fine. Like, I'm anticipating, like, some tough post game fights, and that's going to be enjoyable. That's where we'll find the difficulty, maybe. But this is a game that is just very. The original game was very lean. It's very tight, right? There's not a lot of fat on this bone, right? It is all meat, and it's delicious.
A lot of extra side stuff to do, but like if you're just romping through the game, it's very breezy.
Yeah, but even then, the side stuff is not. It's not taking you 5 to 10 hours like off in one direction. No. You know? It's not like a traditional RPG where like, oh, this side quest is going to take an hour or two. There's nothing like that, right? Like there are some mini games that are all fun. What I really like about this, and I've kind of remembered playing through this version, is every place you go has something new. Like whether it's a new mini game or a new like way that the town's laid out or a new event, every single place has something unique to it. So it really makes like this ultimately fairly small world feel really meaningful and fun to explore, because every single time you go to a new map node, there's something totally different there, right? Whether it's like the minecart mini game, the Midas River, the waterfall one, going to the Yoshi's Island, Yoster Isle to do the racing, or the minecart was really tough for me, but I love the booster beetle race up the mountain. And that's gotten even better. Yeah. Like they really improved that one. The end of that is just nuts. How like with the red barrels and the snippets, like it's crazy. But yeah, I love how just unique every part of this game is.
Yeah, no, I feel much the same way. It's like if you would have asked me like they're re-releasing Super Mario RPG in 2023, what does it look like? It'd be this. It's great, and we haven't even talked about the music yet. The goddess Yoko Shimomura, composer extraordinaire, which this is the game that I heard and made me look up who is the person who composed this. Very much up. I mean, it's no Chrono Cross. Chrono Cross is my gold standard for this is like the best gaming soundtrack of all time. Super Mario RPG is up there though. And the everything they did for this soundtrack, it's perfect. Absolutely adore it.
When we get remasters, remakes, I'm generally kind of split. I'm like, oh, I like some of the new stuff, but I mostly like the old stuff. This one, I think every version is this updated version is awesome. I think they're all so good. I'm amazed that they found a way to take basically every track that I knew and loved, and they made them all great. They're all I think live up to that really high standard of the original soundtrack, which is an incredible set of earworms, and still very, you know, very excellent to just put on today and really enjoy. I found there was a recent OC remix Mario RPG soundtrack, and it's fantastic, and those are good too. But yeah, the versions here in this remake are sublime. They really showed kind of reverence, I think, to the originals and added some fun tweaks to them.
Yep,
sounds like it's good. I don't know if you guys have any final thoughts you wanted to get in before I moved on to listener mail.
No, it's very good. We'll probably have some coverage of this. If you pressure me enough, maybe there will be a book to get.
Yes.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes. Continue the book train. Let's go.
Yeah.
Just tell us what books you want us to write.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
There might be half of a script of some sort that I need to finish. A lot more I could say about this game and how wonderful it is, how impactful it is, and how I think it's just a linchpin for a lot of the personality that the Mario franchise has had over the past 25 years.
Can I leave us with one final thing, just a little bit of speculation? So this year we're getting the Mario RPG remake. Next year we're getting Thousand Year Door. Like, do you think there's anything to that? Like, other than just like it's the end of a console and like we're doing the remake thing, but like to have them kind of in back-to-back years, does that mean like maybe early on or whatever the next Nintendo console looks like, maybe there's going to be something new? It won't be the next Paper Mario. It'll be something different. I don't know. Like, I just wonder if there's something to read there.
Whatever the next Paper Mario is, we do not know who's making the Thousand Year Door remake, because the company, I mean, Intelligent Systems obviously involved.
Yeah.
But I mentioned when I was talking about Taro Kudo, who Vanpool, a company that closed earlier this year, was assisting with development with the past three Paper Mario games. So I mean, like, I'll be extremely curious to see who is, you know, assisting with development with Thousand Year Door, or if it is just for some reason all Intelligent System. It's probably Bandai Namco is helping out with that.
Could be Art Piazza.
Could be.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a company that's going to be working more with Nintendo on remakes like this. I think as somebody who is, am I the more minority of thinking Origami King is absolutely incredible?
I believe that is, I mean, probably not the minority as far as people who actually played it. Minority as far as the internet at large, yes.
I mean, like, yeah, like, I think Origami King is incredible, and I would love to see them continue to build off of that. You know, it is not, those games became adventure games at a certain point, and I think they're very good. But they are not the RPGs of 64 and Thousand Year Door. There is a part of me that doesn't know if I'd read too much into them doing Super Mario RPG and Thousand Year Door. I think it was either the NWR Discord or the Talk Nintendo Discord where somebody posted a comment about, like, I wonder if they'll remake more Mario RPGs, or like maybe they'll do the Mario Luigi series. I'm like, they did.
Right.
Nobody bought them.
Yeah.
It's probably part of the reason why Alpha Dream is dead. But it's more like I do recognize that, like, you know, Mario and Luigi games being farted out at the end of the 3DS's life is different.
Is it that different?
Because these two are getting farted out at the end of the Switch's life. It's just that the Switch is still successful, whereas when those came out on the 3DS, the 3DS was near death. But I do look at that, and I mean, Nintendo never really stopped making Mario RPGs or remakes of them. I guess we had a little bit of a lull, but yeah, like I would be curious to see after these two games, like, what is next?
Yeah, will what's we next? That's really what I'm curious about. Yeah. Like, you put these two games out, and you think, okay, these are two of the most beloved, I think, of the Mario RPGs. And so you're thinking, okay, yeah, what could be the next thing? Like, maybe they're going to see how these ones do and make a decision. You know, obviously they're planning well in advance, but I'd be curious if it had impacted them at all. So this we'll see. But,
I'm going to be very fascinated by the sales of both of these.
Yeah, me too.
More than 12 people will get to play Fast Your Tour now.
So, yeah. I mean, this is really their Black Friday game, right? Super Mario RPG, this is the closest to Black Friday. So is it going to get that bump that we see with games that come around this time? There's no Pokemon, right? There's no, I mean, you had Mario Wonder last month, and that's obviously going to sell a lot too, but this is the game adjacent to Black Friday.
Right? I do think something that you can kind of look at how some of just like Switch and overall across the industry holiday lineups have been going. The game releasing the week before Black Friday or whatever, this release spot is less important than it was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Because if you do look at it, how, like, I feel like I could probably look at this to get specific actionable research on this. Like 10 years ago, I mean, 10 years ago, I think, was when Xbox One and 3D World and Link Between Worlds all came out on that. Probably Sunday before Black Friday, I think. Mm-hmm. I think Nintendo was doing Sunday release dates then.
Yep.
But like, you could look to Assassin's Creed would be a November game. I think Call of Duty was still a November game this year, but like a lot, like all of those big AAA games, you know, major Nintendo games, they would all hit in that you know, those couple of weeks before Thanksgiving. If you look at how it's been, you know, this year, Spider-Man 2 and Mario Wonder, both Sony and Nintendo's biggest games, came out at the end of October.
Yeah.
Starfield, arguably Microsoft's biggest game, that was in September. New Assassin's Creed was October. Like, that's kind of like that late October window seems to be the one where there's more emphasis put on that. Still think Super Mario RPG is positioned to be an important holiday game. But I think that this release date is less important than it was in the past.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, also I guess kind of in the same vein, like, you also have 2023 just filled with so many incredible games, right? That, like, by the time you get to this point, it's like all these other games can be on sale that people were probably waiting for sales on, you know?
Yeah.
So just a kind of a wild year to end with Mario RPG being one of the last major releases. Like, it's kind of funny.
In a year
to think
where Nintendo
that.
Didn't have any more major releases.
It's this is really, it's just a C tier game.
Yep.
You know, like, I'm sure that the dude who made the comment about how there being nothing left after Tears of the Kingdom. Sure. Some of those people are totally nice human beings.
I can call out exactly. I can tell you exactly what dude it was, but
I'm refraining from it. It's not hard to figure out, but like, it's hilarious. Yeah. It's so funny that also, like, it's the weaseling out of, like, I saw one of those dudes be like, oh, like, Mario Wonder didn't do that well. It's like, it sold fucking 5 million copies in like a week, man.
Yeah.
Like, terrible. What does it have to do?
That's probably how many copies Mario RPG will sell in its lifetime.
Maybe. Like, if it got to 5 million, I'd be very excited for the future.
I'm just assuming, I'm figuring that a JRPG on Switch can do about 2 to 3 million.
I mean, that's very high end.
Right. This is a high end JRPG.
And I think Origami King, I think, did 3.5.
Yeah. This has people assuming it's good, though. Whereas Origami King, the deck was kind of stacked against it.
Yeah. So, and it still did very well. It's still, I believe, Origami King might have been the highest selling one in the entire franchise.
Yeah.
But Super Mario RPG, like, if it hits 5 million, that would be really cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that probably means that maybe they work out. Maybe Gino and Mallow have a future beyond this game. Maybe.
Don't give them hope again, Neil. Don't give them hope again.
Give me Paper Mario Legend of the Seven Stars.
Here's what I'll accept. If they put Mallow in Smash, but not Gino, that's fine.
Yeah. Literally any other character. The Axum Rangers as an assist trophy.
Right.
That would be cool.
I don't need Mallow to win. I just need Geno to lose. That's where I'm at on Smash Bros. Characters.
Yep.
But all of that talk of very good games that came out this year leads very nicely into our first bit of listener mail, which comes from Chariot Goblin and says, the Game Awards 2023 nominations were announced. Two Nintendo games and one Sony game are in Game of the Year, while Xbox got, quote, snubbed. It's funny hearing many salty Xbox fans complain about Xbox media bias and trying to say Nintendo doesn't deserve two nominations, belittling Mario and Zelda's accomplishments. What are your thoughts on the nominations? Do you think there is a media bias against Xbox? Thanks, and keep up the good work.
But before we even get to this, this came up when we were talking about our own Game of the Year process.
Yeah.
Have people turned on Mario Wonder? Or is this just a Berube thing?
Here's the thing.
It's always just a Berube thing. But
this, yes. So this is kind of a multi-part question. Nintendo has both Tears of the Kingdom and Wonder have been nominated for game. This email is just talking about Game of the Year specifically, not any of the other categories. Mario Wonder, Tears of the Kingdom, Spider-Man 2, Baldur's Gate 3, and Alan Wake 2 as a surprise arrival in the Game of the Year discussion have all been nominated. As a Nintendo and Xbox fan, Baldur's Gate 3 should win Game of the Year. Out of that list.
Out of that list. I would not be upset by, honestly, by the way that I've heard people that like Alan Wake talk about Alan Wake 2.
Yeah. Same.
Any game on that list, I would just be like, oh, cool, if it won.
So
even if I could make funny jokes about how Tears of the Kingdom is just a remake of Breath of the Wild.
And here's my thing kind of going into this, as far as like the Xbox stuff goes. I don't think there's a media bias against Xbox. I do think there's a general, like, Xbox is in third place. There is a contingent of Sony fans that really enjoy Xbox being in third place and will really pick apart anything Xbox does. And I will say that if I were making these Game of the Year nominations, I'd probably swap out Mario for either Starfield or Hi-Fi Rush. I think I liked both of those games better. But I don't think that there's a media bias against Xbox. I think if you look at the games that were nominated for Game of the Year by Game Awards, they went on Metacritic and they chose the highest rated ones. They did that and then they were like, well, we can't do Hogwarts Legacy because we'll get in trouble. So they picked the five highest rated games on the list. And that was it. Starfield and Hi-Fi Rush are both like 8.5s. Great games. Some of my favorite games of the year, but they didn't score as high as Mario Wonder or Zelda. Even though I think that both of those games did way more interesting things than either Mario Wonder or Zelda, especially Zelda, which I love, but it was kind of just expanding on something that had already been done.
I mean, I look at it with looking at specifically this year as any kind of media, it's Xbox's chances. It's the two games that you pointed out, Starfield and Hi-Fi Rush. Mm-hmm. And while I think Starfield, it's a marketing fail. Like Microsoft has gotten their asses kicked from a marketing perspective. I think it's some self-owns there as well. Like, I still think back to there was some event earlier in the year where there was an Xbox exec being like, the most important RPG of all time, Starfield. And like, you're just setting yourself up to failure.
Right.
Unless this is truly like, I remember the year that the Switch came out, building up to that. A refrain that I kept on repeating is that, like, this console looks very cool. Nintendo in 2017 needs to market a perfect game. Nintendo marketed a perfect game. They had the perfect lineup to go out along that. Like, Breath of the Wild hit. They had Mario Kart the month after. even ARMS, like, you're doing cool things. There's a regular cadence of releases. You had Mario Odyssey at the end of the year. You even had Xenoblade Chronicles 2, which I was very excited for until I played it. But like, they marketed a perfect game, and Breath of the Wild was a game that, like, just, they said the right things leading up to it. They showed it off in the right way, and then leaned into it in the right way after it came out. I think Microsoft in the build up to Starfield continued to fumble the ball. So that way, by the time it came out, like, there was just so much swirl around it that it did not. I mean, I have it installed on my Xbox. That's as far as I've gotten with it. So I can't even really speak to the game's quality other than it is a Bethesda game. So I don't expect it to run perfectly, but it'll also probably be crazy fun. And it also seems like, guess what? Starfield's a weird niche game. Like, it's not the kind of thing that appeals at the level of a Spider-Man 2.
Right. Yes.
And it doesn't have, like, Baldur's Gate 3, for example. You look at the marketing for that. Perfect. Like, they,
well, there
did
wasn't
everything.
Any.
Well, no, like, I've actually, oh God, what was it? There was the dude who does NoClip.
Yeah.
He actually has, he had a video on it. He's doing it with some YouTube channel I've never seen, but Danny, oh God,
Danny O'Dwyer.
Danny O'Dwyer. He used to do a video series on GameSpot ages ago, and now he's basically doing that again. He had one on Baldur's Gate 3 that was very good. Highly recommend watching it. But it is talking about how they marketed that game, how there was, like, there was a moment where it's like the bear sex scene, which I think that got a pop at Summer Games Fest or something along those lines. And, like, that was kind of the beginning of the mainstream, like, what is this game about? And hearing a lot of what Larian has said about, like, their strategy for that game across early access and how they built it out to the main release was, like, one, I think they knew they had magic on their hands and they knew how to play the hand. I don't think Microsoft knew how to play the hand of Starfield.
So with Baldur's Gate, like the bear sex scene, that came out of a fan event that then gained a bunch of traction. Like, they essentially marketed that game accidentally through word of mouth. They can say that was their plan, but, like, Baldur's Gate marketing, I think, was a very happy accident. I don't think that Baldur's Gate marketing, that does not feel planned to me. It worked.
It still was better than what Microsoft did with Starfield.
And then, well, here's my thing with Starfield. So saying it's the most important RPG of, you know, anyone's life is so dumb. Don't put your game on that pedestal. But then I will also say that what outside of that one comment, like, what did they mess up?
The fact that how much longer it came out, how they emblazoned a release date and then missed it by almost a year. And granted, there are reasonable reasons for this to happen.
Right.
But
that's
all
a COVID
part of
delay.
That.
I mean, that's, you can't plan for that in your marketing.
That is like, that's still the thing that, like, it's not a positive marketing thing to be like, we're going to come out on 11/11/2022. And then the game comes out 10 months later.
Right. I guess maybe I think we have different. I think we're defining what our market, like, what I guess I'm talking about
that,
like,
is part
marketing.
Of marketing,
right?
The
but
release
I'm talking
date
about,
and how you announce it is,
yes,
part of marketing.
But I'm talking about marketing strategy, and you're talking about how it ultimately
that
went.
Is
you
marketing
can't...
strategy. There was strategic marketing to say this is the release date, and then you fucked it up, and it was delayed
you,
9 months
but
later.
You didn't fuck it up because you announced it at a point where it was a COVID delay, like. You can't. That's
but you
not,
announced
you can't
it when COVID,
that,
COVID was ongoing.
But you don't.
That's
you
still
don't,
a marketing strategy fail.
But not if you have something like that where you can't really plan around it. You don't know what the long term effects of that are going to be. You don't know how
when,
that's
when
going
did they,
to affect
when
something.
When did they announce 11/11/2022? Unless it was March 2020, then that's bullshit and they fucked up.
Even if it was 2021. It's you're in a position where you're going, okay, like, the vaccine's out, things should be getting back on track, and then they didn't. Like, that's, you cannot plan for that. That's not a marketing strategy fail. That's well,
then
a teaser.
Then don't, when you don't have a full vision of what the next year and a half will be, do not commit to an
but
exact date.
You can think
you know
you
what
do.
Nintendo did. Nintendo did delay Zelda. They didn't give an exact date for 2022. They had their Anuma with a haircut delay, and everybody kind of expected it was going to happen. And that game came out, sold gangbusters. Everybody loved it. We can make fun of it for being a remake of Breath of the Wild. But regardless, Nintendo did the right things around marketing because they did not say it's coming out on November 11th, 2022, and then delay it a year.
I wonder if something that hurt Xbox was the fact that in the they've been in the news cycle for this Blizzard Activision acquisition for such a long time, and it got drawn out because of the legal things that were going on, right, and the different places that wanted to stop it from happening. And so that dragging on is a negative on their momentum, right? They can't kind of escape that. They want to just like put that in the rear view, get it done and celebrate it and enjoy it, but instead it's getting kind of dragged out and it's just taking too long. And so every time, oh, is Xbox in the news again? Is it about a new game coming out? No, it's about this stupid thing getting dragged out, like we just all want to be done, you know? Like, I wonder if that hurt their chances of establishing more momentum this year.
Well, I mean, I think their momentum this year was good. I think their momentum the previous years has been problematic.
Redfall being a bummer did not hurt the overall perception.
Yeah. Yeah, Redfall was, I think, their big, because otherwise their year was pretty good compared to recent Xbox years.
They committed to the November 11th date 11 months before. It was the Game Awards 2021 when they did that.
Okay, yeah. So they thought they were clear of COVID and then turned out they were not.
I also don't know if that was their code. Like, that's still, that is a fail on your part for committing to a date that you didn't hit. It does not hurt the overall, it hurts the overall perception of the game for how that played out, whether it's a reasonable delay or not.
I agree that it hurts the perception of the game.
Yeah, you could say, you could have said we're planning it for holiday 2022 and it would have been way less of a impact on the game as opposed to saying a specific date.
They wanted the 11 because it's a Skyrim date.
Yep. I remember at the time being like, oh, I guess they're really confident that they're going to hit that date. And then they almost missed it by a full year.
Now, what I will say is the game they ultimately released runs a lot better than Tears of the Kingdom. That's,
I mean, it's also got like what magnitude more power on the system.
Oh, I just mean in general, like compared to its, you know, compared to its own goals. I've had way more issues with Tears of the Kingdom than I have in Starfield.
I don't think I really had that many issues with Tears of the Kingdom. Other
even
than
just from
being
straight
on
frame rate issues.
Yeah.
Beyond anything horribly complicated.
Are you playing Starfield on like Series S though? Because that I imagine might be a rougher experience.
Weirdly, excellent on Series S.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, no, it's actually one of the better Series S ports. That's the thing. They had that extra year and released what is, having played most Bethesda games at launch, the most stable and polished and finished Bethesda game I ever played in my life.
I mean, it probably is that Bethesda was like, yo, we got it. And the Microsoft saw the build. Like,
honestly, possibly.
Before November 11th, they were like, guys, no. And they're like, no, this is how we ship all of our games.
Right. Honest, that you might not be wrong. Like, it could be. That's actually an interesting thought. It could be that Microsoft goes, hey, when can you deliver this game? They go, November 11th, 2022. Microsoft goes, great. And then heading into November 11th, Microsoft sees the game and goes, oh, that ain't done.
Yeah.
And Bethesda goes,
But anyway, long way to say that I think Starfield's perception hurt it for getting any kind of nomination here. I think Hi-Fi Rush, Hi-Fi Rush is a game that I bounced off of pretty hard compared to everybody else that loves it. I do think the story of that game, the style of that game is incredible. I think it did get some kind of nomination.
It got like five nominations. Yeah, no, Hi-Fi Rush did still get some love. Starfield's just the big story because that's, you know, the big game. But no, Hi-Fi Rush, you know, not game of the year nominations there, but definitely got nominations.
This is also a year where I think the idea of a snub is almost inevitable because there's so many damn games this year, you know, like someone was going to be left out, unfortunately, you know.
That's the funny thing. If Starfield had come out in 2022 in the condition that it came out in 2023, I think it's a reasonable contender.
Yeah.
Like, it's just in this year where I'm looking at Tears of the Kingdom and then going, oh, Baldur's Gate 3 should win. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, exactly. That's right. Like, how often is that going to happen?
Yeah.
Who won? I do love looking at the Game Awards Wikipedia page. The first half is the announcements. So here were the nominees for game. Oh, yeah. Elden Ring won. No, Elden Ring still would have.
Elden Ring still wins. But Starfield's probably nominated last year.
Yeah, probably.
I think so.
Yeah.
Xenoblade got a Game of the Year nod.
Yes. It was a slim year, man.
Yeah.
Like, it was.
Where's the family games? What Nintendo games got nominated?
Mario and Rabbids.
God. Oh, Kirby and the Forgotten Land. Honestly, mm-hmm. that should have gotten a Game of the Year nod.
Yeah. It was pretty close. Yeah. It's probably on the list, just not quite on the top five.
But the other, so Elden Ring won, and the other nominees were Plague Tale, Requiem, God of War Ragnarok, Horizon Forbidden West, Stray, and Xenoblade Chronicles 3, which is really funny because
Stray,
I feel like
fucking God, yeah. what yeah. Stray is God a of, 7 out of 10 game.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Like, God of War Ragnarok and Horizon Forbidden West are just playing the parts of Mario and Zelda.
Was Stray PS where, exclusive?
Yeah, because
that's three PlayStation exclusives for last year, right? It's kind of crazy.
Stray was also on PC when it came out.
Okay. Got it.
Everybody being upset that Pizza Tower didn't get a Game of the Year nomination. I'm like, yeah, that was like an indie release that came out on PC at the beginning of the year. Like, that's not out on consoles. It is not visible.
Yeah, there is not a bias against Microsoft. I do think there's a bias towards Sony, but that's just me being a fanboy of the other two.
I think it's Sony. Sony does a very good job with marketing. It's really what it comes down to.
You know the type of movies that are like very clearly made to win Oscars?
Yes.
That's what Sony does.
Yeah.
Like, no, they make games that are built to win awards. And they're
God
very
of War
good
Ragnarok is Oscar bait.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Spider-Man marketing was all over the place, though. It was very, very visible, right? And they were hitting it constantly.
I'll also say, I'll be someone playing Spider-Man 2. That game fucking rocks.
I'm excited to play it, yeah.
It is. I'm slowly working my way through it, and it is one, how much it clowns on the original game, in my opinion, and how much it builds off of Miles Morales, which I think is incredible.
But do you think it's fair to put that in kind of the same, I haven't played it, is it fair to look at that the same way we're kind of looking at Tears of the Kingdom, where it's like, this is a great game that builds off of what the last one does, but ultimately my like thinking that it should win or not win is kind of hampered by how much of the previous one is it's built off of?
I think you get to that point where it's like, what games would even be nominated then?
Baldur's Gate 3.
Granted, but I mean, that is building off of Divinity 2. And Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. It's, like
well, Divinity 2, I'll give you. It does not build off of Baldur's Gate 1 or 2.
But I'm just, I mean, it's building off the reputation of that. But like, I will admit that this is being devil's advocate-y, because I do think that Baldur's Gate 3 stands alone. It is vastly different from Divinity 2. It just really, I mean, once again, like, Larian Studios is a fascinating place, just because like they build the tech for Baldur's Gate 3 all comes from work that they did on the previous two Divinity games. Right. Like, if you start to be like, oh, well, this is a follow-up to this game, it's like, then what games would even be eligible? Like, Elden Ring last year, you could make the argument that, like, well, it's just following after Dark Souls and Bloodborne and shit. Like,
right, with Spider-Man and Zelda, it's that case of, like, they're both games where it's, we've taken the last map, we made it bigger, and kind of put a very similar game in it. Is more where like that comparison is like that feels like a very similar style of sequel. Is where I specifically draw the comparison with Zelda and Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, I mean, with both of those games, it feels a lot of like the first game's kind of like introduced an element in the style of game. Even though, if I think the Spider-Man games are way more like old school, very much like old school open world games in a way, which is kind of part of the reason why I like them. But I think a lot of those are inventing an element, and these sequels are perfecting the element.
Yeah,
sure. Okay, in the interest of trying to wrap this up, because I know Jordan's got to get going, I'm gonna real quick get to the next listener mail. Vince says, I always see The Legend of Zelda Oracle of Ages and Oracle of Seasons lumped together in retrospectives, generally because they were released on the same day in 2001, giving the impression that, like Pokemon, they could be the same game with minor differences. Would the Zelda Oracle games be better remembered if they had been released 6 months to a year apart instead of the same day? Regardless of your yes or no answer, if released separately, which would you release first? Jordan, give me your thoughts on this first so that you can disappear if you need
sure,
to.
Sure, sure. Yeah, this is an interesting question and a tough one. Like, I think that they better remembered, I don't know. There is something about them together and the fact that you could link, there was some functionality of linking them up, right? If you beat both, you can kind of get like an extra
there
dungeon or something like that.
There is like a true ending at the end. If you beat one, take a code and put it in the other one.
So you might lose that if you, I mean, you could still do it, I suppose, if they were released separately, but there's something about them together. So I'm going to say better remembered. I wouldn't say that. Maybe appreciated more. Maybe like people would think more fondly of them or something like that. If you could kind of see them as separate entities, are they more memorable? I don't know about that. This is tough for me. I'm not sure. I think it would have been a good idea to maybe do them separately. I think that when I think of playing them, I get like, oh, I don't know which one I want to play, so I play neither. As opposed to like maybe if I could think of them as being more distinct, and they are. But just a little bit more so in my mind, I would go back to them a little bit more often than I do. Now it's like, if I go back, I do feel in a little bit of compulsion to play both.
Yeah. Yeah, I do think they have the quality to stand on their own.
Yes, yes.
Like, they definitely could have been released separately.
I think my counter to this is, I feel like Minish Cap is also not really that. I feel like it's remembered much in the same way as Oracle of Seasons and Ages, and it did not have a similar game come out on the same day. I think, if anything, it is not the fact these came out on the same day. I don't think it would make a difference if they were 6 months to a year apart. I think it's the fact that they came out on a portable system, and were not something like Pokemon, where that's the only place you could play a game like that. Right. And people discount handhelds and don't think they're real.
Yeah, they were always the lesser games as compared to, you know, they came out around the same time as Majora. Like, it was like right around Majora's Mask, right? That was 2000?
Yes, yeah. I think it was earlier that year.
Yeah, so
I want to say they were May releases. My memory might be off.
So do you think it could hurt them that no one can remember what's the major difference between them? Like, that one is action and one's puzzle? Like, which one is which? Like,
oh, yeah, they're like
I don't know.
Different games.
Well, I mean Seasons is action, Ages is puzzle.
Right.
And I probably have that wrong.
Right, exactly.
That
yes,
right.
That's my
you
point.
Have that right. Because I got Ages, my little brother got Seasons. I didn't play Seasons until I was an adult and didn't realize, because like, he just cruised through Seasons, and I was like, man, like, that's, you were like way better at this than I am. And then I played that, and I'm like, oh, you got the easy one.
You just had
a bunch of kill rooms.
They were gonna do a third one. Like, they were plans to do a third one.
Yeah,
not simultaneously or after, or
I think I it was simultaneously.
I think it was simultaneously.
That's crazy. Yeah. Oh, that is nuts.
Yeah, I wonder how much of whatever that third one was wound up in Minish Cap. Or if there's any ties there. Minish Cap is the best of the three Capcom ones.
Minish Cap rules. Yeah. I love Minish Cap. Chapters of Power, Wisdom, and Courage. The Chapter of Wisdom would feature an item called the Magic Paintbrush, which was used to solve color themed puzzles.
Well, they reused that in Bowser's Fury.
Yeah. Mystical. And there was also one, there was a time where there were, I think, rumors or stuff about that the third game would have been a remake of the original Legend of Zelda.
I do remember that. Yeah.
But anyway, like I don't think them coming out at the same time was the death knell. I think it has more to do with being a Game Boy game, when people kind of disregarded that as like, oh, like, that's the junior version. Yeah. Of the series. I think if these for some reason came out on like Nintendo 64, they would be much more fondly remembered.
Yeah.
I mean, when Link's Awakening came out, like, that was, you know, there wasn't a lot of options, right? So you played Link's Awakening, you realized it was awesome. But by the time these games came out, there were a lot of other options for Zelda games and games like this, right? So the competition's a lot different.
Yeah. We were two games deep into 3D Zelda by then. Like, it was
Yeah, I would also say, which one would you release first? I'd do Seasons Before Ages, do the easier one before the harder one. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with
that. Makes sense.
Those are, I've been meaning to, because when they came out on 3DS Virtual Console, I've actually never finished either of them until I finished Seasons on 3DS Virtual Console. Now that they're on Switch Online, I should actually beat Ages.
I want to do that too. I feel these are games I feel like I've started two or three times and only gotten about 40 to 60% of the way through and then dropped for whatever reason. I wish I felt stronger.
Jordan, again, do I have your commitment to a 2D Zelda game club in the future?
Yeah, if you want to do these, one or both. I mean, again, I need something like that to kind of push me to do it. Like I do want to play them. They do feel like a little bit of a blind.
I'm looking for.
They feel like a blind spot to me, and I mean, I need that to get me to play them. I gotta flip through a list of games. Like, oh, I could play that tonight, but let's keep looking, and then I don't go back.
Yeah, I played like the first dungeon of Minish Cap, and man, that game is great. I want to go back.
Minish Cap's fantastic.
Best 2D Zelda.
Hopefully, Nintendo will play into our hands. We'll do our Paper Mario game club, and you know, Thousand Year Door will come out next year, and then they will be like, and there's a 2D Zelda coming out in 2025.
Oh, God, that'd be great. Awesome. I'd be so happy about that.
Please make it I want it to be pixel art, not 3D, though.
It has been, 15 years since the last good new 3D Zelda or 2D Zelda?
Assuming we're talking about Link Between Worlds, then...
Is it really 15 years? No way.
It is almost 10 years to the day exactly for Link Between Worlds. I was being derogatory because that game is largely...
I wasn't sure if you were giving it crap or you just couldn't remember how long it had been.
It is a... I think Link Between Worlds is very good, but it is essentially like a remix of Link to the Past.
Call it a reimagining of Link to the Past.
Like a truly new, and that's also good, is Triforce Heroes is not good.
Oh, God.
Right. No.
As somebody who probably gave that one of the more positive reviews, like mistakes were made.
Yeah.
I would consider Spirit Tracks potentially the last truly new good 2D Zelda game.
Rocks. Spirit Tracks is bizarrely good.
And that was, I think, 2009. So it is just weird for how Zelda's kind of gone this renaissance with Breath of the Wild. Mm-hmm. And from the 2D side, really all we have to show for it is a remake and a bunch of like low-key ports in the form of Switch Online and like a Game & Watch.
Yeah. Well, all right. I think we're going to call that an episode so that we can send Jordan away. But Jordan, before you go, remind everybody to buy your book.
One more round of plugs. So A Game in the Life, available now, ebook form, physical coming soon. If you haven't picked it up yet, again, it's $4.99 US, about $6.99 Canadian. Pretty affordable, I think. You won't regret it. You'll enjoy it. It'll fill you with nostalgia, or you know, you can give it to someone who's played a lot of games and it'll do the same for them. You can find it basically anywhere digital books are sold, Amazon, Google Play Books, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, other places too. Go to nwr.com. You can find the news article there that gives you the links to all the places you can buy it, or you can remember bookstoread.com/gameinthelife. You can find the links there as well. The support's been great, but yeah, if you have picked it up, or you do pick it up, please, you know, leave a rating, leave a review. Helps with visibility of it. It helps get the word out, and then more people get to read it. That's awesome.
Great. If you hate the book, you can send your hate mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. And me and Neil will ignore it and not tell Jordan.
That's why we're friends.
Tell us what books you want us to make.
Yes, please.
Match NWR staff to books you would like them to write.
Then
we'll make them do it.
Star Fox book, go, John.
It's already been suggested and I'm terrified.
I know you are.
But yeah, thanks for joining me, guys. Thanks for joining us, Jordan. It's been fun.
My pleasure. Thanks, guys, for having me.
Go buy his book.
Go buy the book.
Appreciate that.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.